Hey, how's it going? Before we begin, I want to take a minute to thank everyone who's supported the Discovering Bitcoin podcast by sending, streaming, and boosting precious Satoshis via value for value apps like Fountain and Breeze, or Zaps via Nosta. Hearing tales of discovery and recording episodes of this podcast keeps me sane, and your support motivates me to keep going more than you will ever know. Thank you. Are you new to discovering Bitcoin, the network, the asset, the money? Do you want to get up to speed on self-custody, join the evolution, and know how to hodl your Bitcoin safely, securely, and simply? Discover the Bitcoin Advisor, a dedicated team of proper Bitcoiners, hardcore, ardent maximalists, whose sole purpose is to help you to discover Bitcoin, steer well clear of shitcoins, take self-custody, become sovereign, and ensure that you feel confident every step of the way. Click through to the BitcoinAdvisor.com link located in the show notes and tell them DJ from Discovering Bitcoin sent you. Your first month's free when you do.
Can you explain why Bitcoin is such an attractive financial tool?
Because it is somewhat anonymous, not fully, and because you can move money instantaneously.
So the one thing we can count on is discovery. Bitcoin goes forward in the year 2024.
In the middle words of the Doors,
12, 11, 10,
the time to hesitate
9,
is through.
Ignition sequence start.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
All engine running.
Robert, how you going, man?
Good, man. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thank you for having me. I was telling you off air that your work has triggered a lot of lines of thinking in my own brain. And occasionally on this pod, I spin off into think boy territory. Or at least attempt to. And I don't know if that's always appreciated by the listeners. I don't really care, to be honest. I love the listeners, but I host this podcast for my own mental sanity and really nothing more. It's a joy when people find value in it and certainly send value. But on the whole, this is a check-in with reality for me to make sure that I'm not completely insane in my own Bitcoin journey. And so to that end, the work that you've put out over the years, particularly since 2020, Masters and Slaves of Money, was more or less mind-bending. I put that up there with Jeff Booth's Price of Tomorrow in terms of flipping the perspective I have on the world. And there's a few others. I mean, the What is Money show, there's the Sailor series is great, but my favorite is the Mike Hill series and Anish Kave, and there's a couple of others that I'm blanking on. Vivek? No, not is it?
Vivekhi.
Vivekhi, the anthropologist.
Yeah. He's a cognitive scientist.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's pretty much a philosopher.
Right, exactly. So anyway, man, all of that is to say that, yeah, it's an honor and a privilege to have you on Discovering Bitcoin, and I appreciate you spending some scarce time, finite energy, telling us the tale of how you discovered Bitcoin.
Well, I am happy to spend it with you, and yeah, Bitcoin has been an amazing journey, and like you, I guess I started doing the podcast just to, I don't know if it's for my own sanity, but I guess to clarify my own thinking, right? To talk about these big ideas that sort of start to separate you from the world. If you really get into Bitcoin, you start to disconnect from people around you that aren't going on that same intellectual journey, philosophical journey, really. And so it's good to connect with digital people that share same ideas and values, and you can speak the same tongue and, sanity check yourself. Make sure you didn't, I mean, I guess we all did join a cult technically, but
Fanatics.
As I like to joke, it is the cult with the best money, and it is the cult that is leaderless. And, you know, it's inspiring moral virtue and ethical behavior in people. So if you're going to join a cult, I think Bitcoin's the right one to join.
Yeah, I co-sign that. How did you discover Bitcoin?
Well, I first heard about it in 2014. My friend was running a healthcare software business in Las Vegas, and his head IT guy mentioned it. And I don't know, I just wrote it off. I was just like, that sounds dumb.
Yeah.
And as trivial as this may sound, I'm convinced it was just the name Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I've really, and you've watched a lot of the show, you'll know that we go hard on definitions, right? It's very terminological in the sense that when two people are having a conversation, if they don't have a shared consensus or agreement on the meaning of a particular word, then they start to talk past one another. And I think, in fact, most disagreements resolve to that, basically, a disagreement on terminology.
That's Twitter in a nutshell. So,
yeah, Twitter in a nutshell. And also the limitations of language more broadly. Like, the world is very complex and fluid, and we're using discrete data packets called words to try and deal with it. So it's a very indispensable tool, but I would say that it's also insufficient, in that there are limitations basically to what language and knowledge can do. And so, as trivial as it may sound, I think the word Bitcoin, right? Bit implies something small, trivial, you know, a bit of something, a bit of food, a bit of information. You know, Claude Shannon taught us that the bit is the smallest unit of information, right? It's a one or a zero, basically a unit of surprise. And then coin, obviously, is the smallest, typically, denomination of money. And I think I just wrote it off at face value, so to speak. I heard about it and was like, that sounds stupid. Maybe someday, you know, after 50 versions or iterations, someone will come up with the thing that actually works. But that particular one sounds dumb to me. And I just moved on. And boy, oh boy, that was 2014. I just didn't pay attention, basically, until 2016, 2017. And somewhat ironically, it was the Ethereum marketing campaign that got my attention.
Mm-hmm.
I had started to work for myself at the end of 2016, so I had liberated a lot of time, a lot of brain cycles to look into stuff. So I was doing a lot of reading, and the topic of smart contracts, which Ethereum was marketing itself at the time as like a smart contract platform. A lot of people were writing about smart contracts. That really piqued my interest. And then when I got to Nick Szabo's work on smart contracts, I think it has smart contracts in the title. I can't remember the name of the essay, but Nick Szabo, you know, obviously super famous cypherpunk and essayist thinker in the space. Probably one of the ultimate think boys, the OG think boy. He wrote that piece on smart contracts, I think in the late 90s. And he basically described this, you know, the archetypal smart contract as a vending machine, where you've created a programmatic interface between buyers and sellers.
Yeah.
So the seller, you know, puts the candy bars or drinks in the machine, and each item has its alphanumeric code and a price attached to it. And then buyers can come up, deposit the money. You know, if buyer inserts 75 cents and presses A4 for Snickers, and Snickers cost 75 cents, then dispense Snickers.
Right.
That's basically it's the archetypal smart contract. So it's like that realization then scaled up to the global financial sector. Like, global finance is a smart contract, right? It's just connecting buyers and sellers, literally.
That's right.
Lenders and borrowers. And it's just this sort of algorithmic function that's facilitated very labor intensively with human beings. And at least at that point in my Bitcoin / crypto journey, I was like, oh man, you're telling me we can automate a lot of that, right? We can replace these white collar Wall Street jobs with software. And so that was my first light bulb, like, this is going to be a really, really big deal. And so started putting money into, at the time I just had Coinbase. So it was Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin. And I just put some money on the platform and started buying the stuff. And just sort of bought it market cap weighted. So bought mostly Bitcoin, but also bought a lot of Ethereum, a lot of Litecoin. And then the journey began, right? Started, I always say at this point in the story, where my money went, my mind followed.
Right. You got skin in the game now.
Yeah, skin in the game. And I also think there's a deep psychological continuity with money and mind, right? Like we think, we often talk about money as the language of value, right? Obviously, we're both using the open source software English right now, but we also think in terms of money, right? We often negotiate, execute, price contracts and trades and vacations and activities. Like we do these things in terms of money. So if you think in terms of dollars, well, then I think your mind is very deeply connected actually to the Federal Reserve, whether you know it or not. And it may open you up to certain subtle forms of psychological manipulation if you just think in terms of dollars. And I guess the key takeaway there is, like, you have to always consider the denominator, right? The denominator, whatever you're denominating things in, whether it's an actual currency or just a frame of reference, right?
Right.
If you're thinking in terms of how many houses you have or how many cars you have or whatever your metric of success is, that's how you're denominating your own life. So we often, it's almost like, I like Vervaeke's example of you put on the glasses, right? You look at the world through the glasses.
Yeah.
So we're looking at the world through English, or we're looking at the world through our presuppositions or through dollars. But you have to take off the glasses and examine the actual presuppositions or the frame of reference to really get a handle on what you're doing sometimes.
Yeah.
And so, anyways, I basically had skin in the game, started to pay attention, started to go down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. The more I learned, the more I realized Bitcoin was the only decentralized thing in this whole wave of innovation. Everything else started to look a lot more like venture capital. Very unprofessional venture capital at best, and Bitcoin looked something much more like an internet protocol. And so there's like a very bright line started to emerge in my worldview between crypto assets and Bitcoin, and eventually crypto assets, you know, sort of degenerate into shit coins when you realize that, well, there's not really a market proven use case. None of them are actually decentralized. They're all, at best, they're gambling devices. At worst, they're outright scams. And eventually, and then you look at Bitcoin, you're like, well, it doesn't really need to conquer any new technical hurdles to achieve this, you know, 100 trillion plus market, total addressable market. So you start to weigh the cost benefit of, like, what am I holding here? And it's, you know, very tilted in favor of Bitcoin. And so that was the trajectory. And then I guess the nail in the coffin was the Bitcoin Standard in April 2018. Yeah. I was fortunate enough to be far enough down the Bitcoin rabbit hole to read that book the weekend that it came out. I think he released it, again, April. I'm pretty sure it was April 2018. Bought it and read it over a weekend. And I was like, okay, this is... At that point, I had previously, like a decade earlier, read The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Okay.
So I knew central banking was a problem, but I didn't have any Austrian economic plug.
Uh-huh.
So I knew Bitcoin is a big deal. I knew central banking was a problem, but then the Austrian economic plug kind of filled the gap.
Yep.
And then I was just full-blown Bitcoin maximalist at that point. Although I still use the label, because words are important, freedom maximalist, because even Bitcoin, as amazing as it is, I consider it as a means to an end, and that end is human freedom, right? I think Bitcoin is the perfection of private property, price discovery, and political freedom. And as we were talking about offline, there's been a lot of thinkers pre-Bitcoin, centuries pre-Bitcoin, that arrived at somewhat similar conclusions before Bitcoin even existed, that we needed some way to make the sphere of economics independent from political influence, some way to monetize energy, some way to demonetize political currencies, to defund the war machine, and this being like a necessary pathway to the next step of human civilization. And so that kind of gets you into the Bitcoin rabbit hole, which is apparently bottomless. You know, I've been doing this for, again, since late 2016 till today. So what, 8 years almost, and just asking very simple questions. What is money?
Yeah.
What is Bitcoin? What is truth? What is goodness? What is justice? What is beauty? Like, just trying to get underneath the words to gain a deeper understanding and appreciation for the world. And that, you know, a lot of people have joined me for that journey on the show, and it's been amazing. It's changed my life, continues to change my life. And I'm very grateful to do work that I enjoy, something that satisfies my curiosity, and people seem to get a lot of value out of it, which is also very fulfilling.
Yeah, man, look, it's one of those things, right? You probably didn't even have an expectation or any sort of concept with respect to what this thing, this contribution to the space, to just sort of getting these randomized thoughts that are going on in your brain out onto a page, you know, whether it's digital or whatever. But and then obviously with the evolution of the podcast, and then it's effectively evolved into I guess a career, really, which is nuts.
Yeah,
when you think about it.
Yeah. And I'm an introvert, by the way, which is weird, because before this I was a CFO mostly, so just kind of back of the house ops numbers guy. Yeah. I didn't know I had a gift for talking or communicating until Bitcoin showed me that I had this gift.
That's a superpower. And now,
yeah, I feel great. But what did Picasso say? Something about like the meaning of life is to discover your gift, and the purpose of life is to share it with the world, something like that. Like, yeah. It happened organically for me. I never intended to host a podcast or be in the public eye at all. But when I got deep enough into Bitcoin, well, first of all, I got the Bitcoin tattoo. I'd never had it. It's the only tattoo I have. I got it at the bottom of the Bitcoin bear market in November 2018. So Bitcoin was trading at like,
that's conviction,
sub $4,000. At that point, my friends were like seriously concerned about me. They're like, you just got a tattoo of this thing and it's going to zero. Like, what's wrong with you? I was like, you don't understand. This is the biggest thing we're going to see in our lifetime, pretty much. And so when I reached that level of conviction, I basically decided that I would do whatever I needed to do to support the mission. And so I was just listening to the market. You know, people were saying, hey, we like your writing, we like you talking on podcasts, do more of that, please. And it got to the point where I just decided to get out of all my other lines of business and just try this full time. And then serendipitously, Michael Saylor DM'd me in August 2020 when I was flirting with the idea of starting a podcast. And he says, hey, we just bought $250 million in Bitcoin. Thanks for your work. We think it's brilliant. We really appreciate it. And I'm like, who is this fucking scammer sending me a scam link? Like, what is this bullshit? And I look at the link and it's real. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is incredible. And so I didn't know who he was. I didn't know Saylor from Tom, right? And mm-hmm. I just said, hey, do you want to be my first guest on the podcast? We're just going to talk about very basic questions, but we're going to go very long form since the bandwidth is essentially free. And we're just going to see, you know, give the ideas the room to breathe until we can get to the bottom of it, so to speak. And he agreed to come on, and I had no idea he's Michael Saylor. So he's like the perfect guy to give the long form mic to. And that just catapulted the show into notoriety from episode one.
Yeah. That series I've listened to a couple of times, and serendipitous is probably the perfect word for that, the way you've just described it, because if you're going to let ideas breathe and move and evolve and start, particularly from a first principles perspective, you bring on a guy like Saylor, which we all know by now has this incredible way of thinking and articulating fairly complex concepts in a very concise manner, even though if you give him room to breathe, he'll run with it. That series, like, I don't know anyone who's taken the time to listen to those 10 episodes and come away going, maybe next year, or it's probably still going to zero. Like, it's just not going to happen. That information is too powerful.
It's a guaranteed orange pill for sure. And we actually have 17 episodes in total.
Uh-huh.
And that is the longest series I have done, tied for the longest series. We did the Twilight of Gold series, which is also 17 episodes. But yeah, I mean, long form, man. It's partly inspired by Jordan Peterson, who said this very thing, that because of YouTube and podcasts and digital media, that the spoken word now had the reach and permanence of the written word, which I thought was very profound.
Hmm.
And that the cost of the bandwidth is essentially zero, right? Like what electricity, I guess, whatever the equipment costs, it's very low. Especially the longer you talk, right? The more you're amortizing that fixed cost into more and more output. So that was my kind of inspiration. It's like, oh, well, let's just dive into these big ideas and give them all the bandwidth they need and see what happens. And I think there's a larger movement taking place, right? Like we've moved from this kind of one to many or top down media paradigm of the 20th century to a many to many bottom up media paradigm in the digital age. And so with that has come a resurgence of dialogue, right? Dialogos, people speaking freely, and this process of truth discovery sort of has been accelerated, I think, through peer-to-peer communications. And very exciting to be a part of that, you know, to be learning as a beneficiary of that, and to also be a benefactor of that process as a podcast creator. So I think it's a very exciting time to be alive, to say the least. And without Bitcoin, I would be extraordinarily pessimistic. Like, I don't know what, we'd still have all of this communication and we'd be learning about the darkness in the world, but there'd be no hope. Like, there'd be no solution to the rot, right? There's this systemic corruptive rot at kind of the bottom of the socioeconomic structure today. And I don't know what we would do without Bitcoin. So thank God we've got this peer-to-peer communications paradigm, and thank God we have incorruptible money as a potential solution to many of the problems in the world today.
That's the thing, man. We had Catan on recently, and he mentioned that he was getting orange-pilled by Stefan Levera, and Stefan would constantly talk to him about libertarianism ideas and Austrian economics and so on and so forth, and Catan's answer was always, yeah, cool, but so what? Like, none of it's practical. It doesn't matter. Like, who cares?
Yeah.
And of course, when Bitcoin comes along and into his mind, and it starts to become a practical solution to all of these problems. And I think a lot of Bitcoiners, particularly in the last, I'd say, decade or so, that have discovered it, found it, whatever, have done the work prior, like you read Creature of Jekyll Island, say, and that presents this problem. Here's central banking is a giant problem. How do we solve it? Well, we need to get back onto a gold standard. And if you give that any sort of modicum of thought, you'll soon realize that, well, I don't have the monopoly on violence, so that ain't going to happen. and these other sort of documentaries that you see over the years, like, I can recall watching The Corporation and Zeitgeist and a few others. And it's like they frame up the problem. And cool, I've got the problem. The problem is, but maybe it's actually not as clear, the problem, as it is now, once that Bitcoin lens is shined on it, so to speak. You see people on Twitter all the time. There's this one guy I try and interact with often. He's like a journalist that constantly is talking about the issues of the Australian economy and how this is happening and that's happening. And he always reverts back to the political means to solve the problem.
Mm.
And it's fucking frustrating. And so I've come to the conclusion that, like, all right, well, I'm just going to keep nudging this guy and irritating him until he blocks me on Twitter. And that's fine. But if he does block me, then it proves that he's a LARP. because all these people want to do is just complain about the problem. And I don't know about you, but I'm the type of person that sees a lot of problems everywhere. But now that I have this thing that I can anchor to or like look to as a guide to sort of set up a set of rails to orient, I guess, my life in order to just at least for me personally solve some of these problems, not necessarily for the whole world, because I can't feed the whole world. I can't solve the whole problems of the whole world, but I can solve my problems. And this is an incredibly excellent tool to leverage that problem solving ability, you know, and you just wish that more people would actually not dismiss it out of hand. But I mean, that's just the nature of how humans behave, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you first have the Bitcoin revelation, and maybe it's something like if you've ever had a mystical experience, either a religious experience or perhaps on psychedelics or perhaps through some type of practice, right? There's a lot of people that have meditated themselves into mystical experience and everything sort of makes sense all at once, you know, like you kind of see the light, so to speak, and then you want to tell everyone about it. But then as soon as you try to start to tell them about it, you're like, oh wait, the words just can't, can't communicate wisdom in words, right? It has to be, and I'm not trying to sound arrogant or anything here, but it's like, everyone has their own light bulb moment with Bitcoin, and you can't package that up and deliver it to someone else. It's like, they have to do the work, right? It's intrinsic. Again, that's part of the lesson of Bitcoin is the importance of proof of work.
Yeah.
And there's a proof of work necessary to even understand what Bitcoin is in the first place. There are no shortcuts, right? Just like there are no shortcuts in reality when you create, well, that's what money printing is, right? An attempt to take a shortcut. We have some economic imbalance, you know, we have insufficient goods or we have an economic recession. Instead of enduring the austerity that's necessary to overcome that and performing the work necessary to resolve a market dislocation, let's just print money, right? Yeah. Let's just make new slips of paper to feed people and house people and solve other economic problems. And the reality of that shortcut is it comes with inescapable trade-offs, right? You may stimulate demand in the short run when people start to feel artificially more rich in the short run, but what you're creating, you're really sowing the seeds for larger future economic disasters through the misallocation of capital, right? Not to mention all of the coercion that's necessary to preserve the money printing apparatus that is the central bank. Like, you are introducing it's a non-civil element to the world, right? You have to have legal coercion to get people to use the currency that other people can print. This is what legal tender laws are. And so there's kind of a metaphysical rift, I think, that's created. And it's, I think it's really just a bad, you know, what is politics? Maybe what is ethics? Something like a practical application of a group ideology, right? It's like, we have figured out this particular idea structure for how humans interact over time. Let's institutionalize that and let's create a constellation of rewards and punishments, of carrots and sticks that keep people acting in accordance with this ideological structure, right? This is, you know, the rule of law, equality in the eyes of the law, innocence until proven guilty, et cetera, right? These are just ideas that we've discovered over time that are just and or workable, and then we use the rule of law to enforce them. But, you know, somewhere near, I don't think anyone's found, maybe you ever will find, the bottom of the Bitcoin rabbit hole, but when you get down there, you discover the economics of violence. And the book, you know, I've spoken about this book a lot, but the book that really threw a lot of light on this for me was The Sovereign Individual. And then the writings of people like Frederick C. Lane, who are in the bibliography of The Sovereign Individual. demonstrate to a large extent that a great deal of the shape of society is based on how profitable force and violence is, frankly. And so, you know, I won't go into the examples here, but the invention of gunpowder, for instance, allowed a peasant to be able to kill a knight from 100 yards. Well, before gunpowder, the knight was the dominant martial force in the land. So the knights ran the show, basically. Then all of a sudden we invent gunpowder, and well, the knights no longer run the show because a peasant can kill a knight from 100 yards with a rifle. This idea of attack and defense, like how risky or costly is it to attack someone versus how risky or costly is it to defend oneself from being attacked or having one's purchasing power extorted by the state or by criminals. This has a very fundamental effect on the way human beings organize themselves.
Right.
And so I think Bitcoin, again, not the bottom of the Bitcoin rabbit hole, but very close to it, Bitcoin is a step change in the economics of violence. So we have a highly defensible bearer asset that you can defend at very low cost. If you custody it properly, it's damn near impossible to steal with solutions like multi-sig, multi-key. It can't be inflated. It can't be printed. So you don't get this corrosive incentive in the political framework, right? Where the printing of money, like, you know, whoever can print the money will create any pseudoscience or any rationale to justify the printing of that money. You know, that's what Keynesian economics is, right? It's one giant pseudoscience. There's no actual scientific justification for any of that nonsense. It's just an excuse. It's just apologetics for government monopolizing and printing money, basically. And so you start to see where the ideology, like almost the how do we say this? The economics of violence influence the ideology, right? We wouldn't have Keynesian economic ideology if we could not, if we didn't have gold, frankly, right? You need to decentralize gold. Gold doesn't move very fast across space, so you need to centralize it in one place and put a currency or put an application on top of it called currency so you can transact it effectively across space. But when you centralize that much purchasing power in one place, as Lord Acton said, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? We get the most corrupt institution in human history growing up around that, the central bank. The central bank promulgates its own false ideology of Keynesian economics to justify its existence, right? This is like the church of the medieval times.
This is a giant circle check.
Yeah, the church dominates the world because the earth is the center of the universe and we're the biggest institution in the world and therefore we run the universe, right? Like we're the gateway to God. It's like, okay, well, maybe not, right? Somewhat ironically, it's the printing press that brings down the church, breaks their monopoly on knowledge, and then also the printing press, which later enables the central bank, right, to actually to print money. So that's one of those technological ironies of history. But to get to your earlier point, you know, this, I think it was Oppenheimer that said this, there's two means to acquire wealth. There's the political means and there's the economic means. I call these taking. The political means is taking. The economic means is making, right? You can either work, make, and trade with other people consensually, or you can take from those who have worked, made, and traded with one another to create wealth. And so Bitcoin is all about making, or let me try to be careful with my words here. The core value proposition of Bitcoin is that it makes taking, or it makes the political means of wealth acquisition less profitable. And when you make something less profitable, people do it less often. It becomes less prevalent of a wealth acquisition strategy because it doesn't work as well. So by creating a world in which the political means of wealth acquisition is less effective or less profitable, which is just to say giving people a very cost-effective way to defend their purchasing power and to vote against the state with their feet or with their wallet, you get a world where people are much more incentivized to be entrepreneurial, right? To be productive, to engage in long-term trading relationships, to be peaceful, to love thy neighbor, right? And this is an open question, right? How much do economic incentives influence our ethicality? I think a lot. I mean, the way I see it is a lot. It's people will do whatever's profitable, basically.
It's incentives so, all the way down. Forget the turtles. It's exactly. Incentives all the way down.
And I think, you know, Bitcoiners are notoriously disagreeable individually and with one another.
Yes, sir.
But I think that's one thing we probably all agree on. It's incentives all the way down. And so, you know, welcome to the Bitcoin rabbit hole. Like, it may sound, you know, and I want to be careful here because I don't want to sound overly simplistic, because that often sounds like, well, that does sound cultish in a bad way, right? Like, oh, we found the solution to everything. Blah, blah, blah. But it's like, come to the party. Like, think through it with us. There's hundreds and thousands, apparently 100 million people holding Bitcoin today. Everyone's trying to hash out what the implications of this thing are. A lot of people approach it from a lot of different angles, but they all arrive at the same flavor of conclusion, that this is a step change in the right direction for human freedom and human flourishing, right? It's giving people more options. It's giving people a greater tool set to resist oppression and criminality. Like, how could that be bad?
Well, beyond that, I mean, just keep it really simple. It's just more convenient to use. You want to buy something. Yeah. I don't have to put all my details in a credit card just to get a movie off Apple TV. Just show me a QR code. I'll send you, give me a Lightning invoice and I'll zap you some sats. No problem. Like, we'll just do it. Go. Like, it's, you know, from that angle. But going back to what you were saying about Bitcoin as a step change, as I mentioned to you off air, I've been doing a little bit of reading, a lot of reading around Rudolf Steiner, and he's crazy. Like, he's written a lot of stuff, and he's obviously started the Waldorf School and this idea of education coming from the heart first, then the head and the hands. So it's kind of like feeling, thinking, doing in that order. Mm. But he wrote a lot. He touched on economics and stuff. And there's a couple of essays called The Renewal of the Social Organism, in which he talks about capital and credit and economics and all these sorts of things. And I think I'm going to try and start sort of expressing this stuff in the written form. But basically, I was reading this one part of this Renewal of the Social Organism where he was talking about these old ideas that are controlling, that are attempts to control economics by political means and legal means. So you could like rope in lawfare and things like that. These are things that he's been writing about, you know, 100 years or more ago. But one of the things he mentions is this new idea, any new idea, whatever it is. And his idea is that you'll have sort of like these working organizations that will work together on a voluntary basis to trade with one another, trade value, you know, and there'll be contracts and stuff like that. The problem is that he falls down with the fallibility of human beings, effectively. Mm-hmm. And I've written a little bit about this with regards to Plato. This is what Plato wanted to do, is he wanted to instill like a philosopher king and a set of, you know, wise, you know, a Congress or whatever it is to sort of lead the people. But again, you get back to these incentive problems, and eventually that gets corrupted and decays and decivilizes and all these sorts of things. So plugging in Bitcoin into this thing, and I sort of think of it as like a liberating forcing function that elevates individual will or consciousness, motivation, action, cognition, in order to participate in creating and contributing value to society, which is at scale how civilization advances, right? And so the Steiner piece, he effectively, one of his bigger pieces is the philosophy of freedom. And he reckons that that's his like masterwork, and everything that comes after that all anchors to that. But effectively it's boils down to encouraging individuals to think about thinking, elevating their cognition, cultivating cognition and raising their consciousness. And so what I've noticed with regards to Bitcoin is that it elevates my own consciousness. Like, I've always been a curious person prior, but it's given me this like massive lever with which to explore all of these incredible topics that you never thought you'd touch on. And through, and the reason you can do that is because it provides optionality and extra time. because you know that your money's not being whittled away. So you could take a day off if you wanted to and go and explore, read a book, whatever it is. And from that, you can explore all of these crazy terms, topics, whatever, and speak to people like yourself. It's this forcing function that's inevitably going to, I'm not saying it's going to just raise everybody's consciousness. And I watched this video the other day where this guy was offering like a free Hershey's bar and or a free bar of silver. And every single person took the Hershey's bar. Because, I mean, there's this random dude on the street like handing out chocolate bars and silver. And so maybe there's some sort of primal like reaction where they're like, who's this weirdo? But like literally not a single person could even grok the fact that he's holding this heavy bar of silver. They all preferred to take the chocolate bar. And so that's like a really depressing, you know, illustration of maybe the state of things. And so I don't expect that everyone's going to be able to elevate their cognition, but there's going to be a lot of people that will be able to. And if you think about Bitcoiners in plugging themselves into the political realm, like it's game over. Because we're all very, very ethically minded, moral, fair, justified, and disagreeable.
Yeah.
And we can't manipulate the value exchange that we all use. You know, it's incorruptible, it's immutable.
To politics being the practical application of a group ideology, Bitcoin, the technology, the physical protocol, mining software technology is discussed a lot, but I think the ideology is less well understood. But it's exactly what you just described, right? It's like, okay, we'll call it a cult, call it whatever you want, but it's, you're just creating a coalescence of people around common values, right? This used to be called a nation or a city or, you know, a tribe, whatever. And it's really centered on those principles of natural law, right? Just life, liberty, property, mind your own business, tell the truth, work hard. Individuals are sovereign, right? The individualist sovereignty is subordinate to state sovereignty. And you said it raises consciousness, and I haven't read this book, but I've heard it cited a lot. And I think it's called, the book is called Leisure, I'm pretty sure. And it talks about leisure being the basis of culture, that it is the free time that we create for ourselves through economic advancement that we actually use to sit around and think of the next thing, right? Like how to create beauty in the world, how to serve one another, how to create institutions that function well across time. Like it's somewhat intuitive in a way. It's like the free time that we earn through the process of innovation and economization is what we reinvest into the process of civilization, right? We actually think about how we work with one another. We learn from the lessons of history. We read books. So it's not leisure like you're playing putt-putt. You know, this is, people have times to read books and reflect and converse and have dialogue.
It's the definition of a scholar.
Yes.
Like that's the traditional definition. I was watching or reading, listening probably, Alan Watts, Man in Nature. Awesome lecture. But he mentions, you know, the traditional definition of a scholar is leisure. And he says, we talk of a scholar and a gentleman because this person was a person of private income, effectively. He could afford to be a scholar, to take leisure. Didn't have to earn a living, so therefore you can spend all the time in the world studying all of the esoteric things, classic poetry and literature and thought and thinking and all the rest of it. They're not busy. And so, like, it's weird because fiat, we talk about this corruption of fiat, it's corrupted the term scholar into like a scholarship at a university, and all you do throughout your whatever you're doing, your tertiary education, whether it's a PhD or a master's or whatever, is you work. That's not the definition of being a scholar.
Right.
We're kind of being scholarly right here. We've decided to take a couple of, you know, an hour.
That's where
or
I was
so
going.
And
that's
and
where I was going
this.
Is Bitcoin is energizing the emergence of the traditional scholar in this way, right? By right giving on. People a way to protect the fruits of their labor, which is the product of their time, in a medium that cannot be compromised. Mm-hmm. So we can accumulate our time in something that, well, actually doesn't just preserve it. It grows over time because more people figure out, hey, I don't want to be plundered through inflation, so I'm going to hold a better asset. Well, that benefits, obviously, the earlier entrance into Bitcoin. And so we, by insulating ourselves from the time theft of inflation and preserving the fruits of our own time, we buy ourselves leisure just by saving in Bitcoin. Exactly. And in that leisure, you have the fertile soil of scholarship, as you've described. So that is, I mean, I think that is the elevation of consciousness, right? You literally have more time to sit around, think about the world, think about how it is, how it should be, how it has been, talk about it with other people, read old books. I mean, I, you know, like you, I love, it's like, I've always been a curious person too. I now get to sit around and read old books, and I've turned that into a business. I talk to people about it.
It's incredible. It's
scholarship in real time, and all thanks to Bitcoin, right? Yeah. If I didn't have Bitcoin, like insulating the fruits of all my labor from all of this systemic plundering, then I probably couldn't do that. And not, it's not only that though, it's also, and this is a stranger one, what is it about Bitcoin that's making us ask fundamental questions? Like, it's almost like you're like, what is Bitcoin? Okay, Bitcoin is money. Okay, what is money? And then you're off the deep end. You're like, well, shit, that's a whole thing. And it's interesting because it's like, well, if money is this, I guess this point at which language starts to break down, there's other profound questions you could ask where you see language start to break down, right? We mentioned it earlier. What is truth? What is goodness? What is beauty? All these things that Plato and the other philosophers have talked about for a long, long time. The idea of broken money, right? It's as significant as broken truth or broken beauty or broken justice. You know, it's a really big thing that humans struggle to get into language. And if it's not working properly, well, then I think it is roughly equivalent to these other profound topics not working properly in a way. And so I'm not saying that fixing the money will fix everything in the world, but what's that old saying that for every 1,000 hacking at the leaves, there is but one strike at the root? It's like there are a lot of symptoms we're talking about, right? People talk about wealth inequality. People talk about endless warfare. People talk about greedy politicians, right? Nancy Pelosi on a $400,000 salary or whatever is worth $80 million. Like, how is that possible? It's like you can trace all of these leaves back to the common root of central banking and fiat currency. And so, I don't know, like, is Bitcoin, whatever, Plato wanted to appoint the philosopher king to rule society, and he thought that was going to kind of be the ideal thing. But I disagree with that, actually. I think, actually, even Plato said that was one case where coercion was justified. It's like, you needed to find the guy that doesn't want to lead and then coerce him into leading. I'm like, I don't think that.
But we tried that with George Washington, and he went, "Nah, I'm done. 4 years, that's cool. Catch ya."
Yeah. So the better answer, I think, is make at least give everyone the means to become their own philosopher, king, or queen. Right? Like, just give them the keys to their own castle, and let people self-organize in a world where it's very risky, expensive, difficult to violate the property of one another. Therefore, the best way to acquire wealth is to cooperate with one another, because I
voluntary
can't take it from
cooperation.
You, so I might as well work with you.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, it's maybe a restatement of the incentives all the way down, but I don't see a convincing counterargument to that.
I go back Donald Boudreau. He's got an essay called "The Coercivists versus Voluntarists," and that's the spectrum. It's not left versus right. It's coercivists versus voluntarists, and that's it.
That's right.
There's no room for coercion. There really ought to be no room for coercion. The thing with fiat money, you sort of triggered a thought in my head, is it's kind of like dirt. It's like dead soil. Like, you can't grow anything in dirt. It's just erosion. It just washes away. Whereas Bitcoin is soil. It's fertile. It can you can grow things in nutrient-dense, fertile soil. You can grow plants. And then when you grow plants, they start from a seed, from little things, big things grow, and they emerge into their final form, which is the flower. And then they get pollinated, and those ideas spread across the garden or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin allows that is that fertile soil for us to be able to be think boys, right? And have this sort of scholarly conversation where we can kind of dive down rabbit holes and stuff. And it's not just us. It's like hundreds of thousands of people all around the world. And they might not even be necessarily talking about Bitcoin, but they will, you know?
Yeah, and it's incredible because Bitcoin, not only is it a financial singularity, right? It's this fixed money supply that's devouring purchasing power from every inferior store of value in the world. But it also strangely, maybe as a result of that or interrelated with that, seems to be like a intellectual or philosophical center of gravity.
Yeah, that it's an anchor.
The way we look at the world is different as a result of studying Bitcoin, right? Again, just this is where I feel very fortunate with the namesake of the show. It's like, well, you ask the question, what is money? You end up in every domain of human existence. Like, I don't think there's anything money doesn't touch. As you mentioned earlier, the series of Mike Hill, that's a series on metaphysics. Who in the hell knew money had anything to do with metaphysics? But, and maybe it doesn't. Maybe we're reaching. I don't know. But we certainly found a lot of connection points that seemed to make sense to us. And we've talked about everything on the show. We've talked about, you know, anthropology, technology, psychology, sociology, philosophy, physics. I don't know a domain where money hasn't touched. And so, yeah, Bitcoin, again, if we're looking at it as a political system or an ethical system. No, I see.
That's the thing. So I've been thinking a little bit about that
too. This is definitional, though, because I hate the word politics, by the way.
Me too. Can't stand it.
However, there is a sense of the word politics that makes sense to me.
Okay.
This is from John Vervaeke, because I always thought politics is literally the clown running the coercive apparatus that is the state. Right? That's bullshit. I don't, you know, morally unjustifiable. However, John Vervaeke said, you know, to the extent that the free market is distributed cognition, politics is intended to be the complementary element to that, which is distributed ethics. So it's like, how do we act? It's a distributed ethical code, right? In its best form. Obviously, we've polluted and destroyed this to a large extent with our conception of modern fiat politics, but I do tend to agree that distributed cognition is not enough. Like, there also needs to be an ethical code to uphold that. And I think for me, studying libertarian philosophy and the idea of life, liberty, and property is that code, right? You want to respect everyone's life, let them live, do not kill, let people be free as they let you be free, right? Do not incarcerate or restrict people's movement. And do not steal people's shit, right? Do not violate their private property. And so Bitcoin, as an ideological, or the ideological layer of Bitcoin, well, what does it do? It makes coercion less profitable. So that, and therefore defunds the war machine in a way, right? That if you rerun World War II, for instance, where Hitler would invade a country and then go and raid their gold hoard at the local central bank, you rerun that same sequence of events on a Bitcoin standard, and war looks a lot less profitable.
Very expensive. Like,
the carrot at the end of that stick is just not going to be the same as it is on a gold standard. So Bitcoin's preserves life in that sense. Obviously, Bitcoin can be used and transported across jurisdictional boundaries, right? You can put the private key on your brain and cross a border with $1 billion on your brain. Unrestricted. So it's supportive of liberty, right? People can move anywhere they are treated best with all of their purchasing power intact. And then obviously Bitcoin, I consider it to be the perfection of private property, and that it's the one thing that if you hold it properly can be made inseparable from its owner. So you can have this property right that's impossible or damn near impossible to violate. So if we're looking to move into a world that is respectful of life, liberty, and property, I think Bitcoin is in many ways the ultimate ethical system for pointing us that direction, for incentivizing us to move that direction, let's say.
Libertarianism is born from notions of natural law, John Locke, places like that. And then you can obviously go back to the world of God, you know, if you want to go back that far, sort of thing. And God in whatever incantation you want to suggest, it doesn't matter. And it can be Catholicism, Christianity, Buddha, Vishnu, whatever, it doesn't matter. The idea of natural law, though, makes intuitive sense once you start to read about it, understand it. It's almost like, so natural law, nature, it emerges from the natural environment. And the natural environment is what we all inhabit. It's the universe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then from the universe emerges human beings, and human beings act. That's economics. That's praxeology. And then from those actions of economizing time, energy, scarce resources, you emerge, or what emerges is a culture. And then from that culture is politics. Politics is downstream from all of that shit, all of it, right?
Yep.
Nature, praxeology or human action, economics, whatever, culture in all of its many forms. And then politics is but one subset of that human culture, that civilization. Yep. What fiat has done is overridden or hit the override button and put itself between or even perhaps even before nature. Because of that ability to be violent with very little cost, because you can just pay for it effectively with these paper notes or these digital ones and zeros. And so the whole cart is before the horse. And it's just, we're just completely in bizarro world. And so I think with Bitcoin is it's like this, again, it's this, it reorders that to become far more natural, logical, intuitive, and actually makes sense to people. It's just that we've lived under this for, I mean, to be generous, like 100 years, but let's say 50 odd years, and we don't know any better. We've got at least two generations which haven't got a clue. But what's interesting is that there's the second generation emergent from that first one, which is actually starting to poke holes into this problem already. It's not Lindy. This thing is very, very fragile, and it won't take too much to knock it over and reorder this thing. It's just that we're going to be the ones responsible for doing that. But we're effectively just reordering that by using this tool, Bitcoin, to get us back to the natural order, from the universe to culture and everything that comes good from that, civilization, effectively.
Yes. No, that's well said. And again, just to focus that perspective on Keynesian ideology, right? Keynesian ideology says consumption spurs production.
It's retarded.
Which is exactly backwards, right? Like the reality is, obviously, you cannot consume what has not yet been produced.
Mm-mm.
That's anyone that's ever done anything knows that, right? You can't eat the berry that hasn't been picked, right? It's like, it's inversion. It's an inversion of rationality.
But there are people in the world that actually believe that that's possible. Marxists think that, well, what they think really is like, we'll just steal the berries from other people.
Yes.
But they're still not counting into the fact of like, well, hang on a minute. Like those berries still need time to grow.
So the question is, so that you're hitting the nail on the head right here. I mean, okay. Let's assume Marxists think that, because that's the only way you're actually going to get to eat, by the way, in Marxism, right? It's like you're going to need to steal someone else's berries because you're not producing shit, basically. Yeah. So if stealing becomes less probable or possible or profitable, then does Marxism wane as an ideology, right? Is it that order? Is it the, and here's the order I think it's in. It's like we have nature, humans act, right? We use means purposefully in the pursuit of valued ends. In pursuing ends with means. We develop tools and technologies, right? Means that help us satisfy our ends more efficiently. From technology, we get economics, right? You can dig a lot more holes per hour with a shovel than you can with your hands, right? You economize your time through the use of tools. And then at the very end of that sequence is politics, right? The technological paradigm, again, largely as it relates to the economics of violence, dictates our political realities. And so I would argue that the Marxist ideology is actually downstream from technological reality. And maybe that's why Bitcoin is so transformational, is that we're changing the technological reality and the possibility, profitability, or probability of a Marxist being able to eat at someone else's expense, because that individual can now conserve their purchasing power in Bitcoin and leave a Marxist jurisdiction for a more capitalistic jurisdiction, thereby voting with their feet and or wallet, thereby devitalizing Marxist regimes and vitalizing or energizing capitalist regimes. That will lead to the sunsetting of Marxist ideology because of a new technological reality, if that makes sense. So
it creates abundance. It practically demonstrates abundance as well. So there is cause to enact upon that sunsetting of the Marxist ideology, because there'll still be prats out there that will want to hang on to, well, they'll be lazy effectively. They don't want to have to work. They want redistribution.
Redistribution is no longer possible, or it's way less possible than that lazy guy or the guy that wants wealth redistribution.
You get philanthropy.
Whatever, that wants the handout. Yeah, presumably. Maybe he'll just get to fucking work. Right? You get hungry enough and there's no welfare check or whatever the thing is, then you're just going to go work. You're going to do whatever is profitable, frankly.
To survive.
So Bitcoin is making laziness and coercion and incompetence less profitable. It's less prevalent in the human species.
I was reading this Twitter thread a friend sent me. It was to do with music and the degradation of the quality of music in recent years. And she was talking about how it was so good in the 90s. And there was a couple of comments underneath that initial thread. And one of them, I don't know who it was, but they were basically saying that what a lot of people fail to realize is that in the 90s, the dole or the welfare checks that were coming in helped these struggling musicians to write and create this music. And that kind of fostered this sort of really nice period. I was talking from an Australian perspective of Australian homegrown music with all these homegrown festivals and this effective culture that emerged from that. And that kind of twisted my brain a little bit, because I was like, hang on a sec. So, you could potentially argue that welfare led to the creation of...
Yeah, but how do you draw a causation and not correlation?
Exactly. So, but what I was sort of getting at was this person, his point was, we need to bring that back. We need to bring more welfare to these struggling artists. And I'm like, oh, no, that doesn't work anymore. Well, I mean, you know, that doesn't need to be the case anymore, because we have things like Wavelake and Fountain and Value for Value, where we can just send you sats. And if you're good enough, if your content is good enough, your music's good enough, well, boy, you'll get a lot of sats thrown at you, trust me. And then they'll appreciate in value, and then you can invest in all these other things, and you can actually get to work, and maybe we'll have a resurgence of great Australian music again. But yeah, this idea.
Yeah, I'm wary of those, because I've heard similar arguments where people say, oh, look at all the innovation we had in the 20th century. Like, if we took away inflation, we're not going to have that innovation. I'm like, whoa.
No.
You can't just say, well, it rained yesterday and, you know, Kevin Bacon was in a movie, so Kevin Bacon's appearance in the movie made it rain. Like, correlation and causation are not the same thing. And people are very quick to just say, oh, well, there was a period when this happened and a period when that happened, and those periods overlap, so therefore A causes B. You know, and I think it's nonsense. I think all of the innovation in the 20th century happened despite inflation. Because again, you don't need, this is where you get into economic history versus economic science. It's axiomatic that inflation is theft. right? That if you print money and impose its use via a legal monopoly, that that is an instrument of theft. You're diluting the purchasing power of savers, right? And savers are people that have produced but not yet consumed, right? This is potential consumption that they have not acted upon. If you dilute that potential consumption and redistribute it to other people, you're stealing from savers. Every act of theft, and this is axiomatic as well, is necessarily a decrement to production. Because if you spend an hour or a second stealing from someone, that's an hour or a second you did not spend producing, right? Theft, which includes taxation, inflation, regulation by fiat, these are all axiomatically decremental to productivity. So when you get into the argument of inflation drives innovation, like, it's a non-starter for me. I'm like, if you actually look at the words you are using and go to the bottom of what they mean and reason from there, you will quickly unravel the bullshit, right? Basically, it's like there is no moral or symmetric justification for printing money whatsoever. It's only an asymmetric extraction of wealth by those that can print money from those who cannot. Like, that's it. It's, you know, to talk about fiat, right? The original word fiat, fiat lux, God said, let there be light. This was creato ex nihilo, right? Creation from nothing. God created the universe from nothing by saying, let there be light, by decreeing it into existence. Well, that's God, right? Humans can't decree things into existence, yet we have deluded ourselves into believing we can. And I think Bitcoin is just teaching us that lesson, that man is not God. Man cannot decree things into existence. Man must work to create things in existence. And, you know, money that is creato ex nihilo is just no good for us.
You said it a little bit before, like, it fosters this entrepreneurial mindset amongst people, Bitcoin, mm-hmm. or sound money. Incorruptible sound money, whatever. And I think Optimus Fields, I think I heard him say this on an episode of Simply Bitcoin the other day. But yeah, it fosters this entrepreneurial mindset such that you want to go out and produce value for people. And there's this idea that, you know, when it's redistributed through Keynesian economics and Marxist socialist ideas, it removes the need to be entrepreneurial. It removes actually the will to work. And you have to have will. You have to have motivation to act in the world in order to change it, right? And if you don't have that, because perhaps you've been removed, far removed from the actual tangible work that you're doing. And I think, you know, there's one thing, and I cannot remember it word for word, and I don't want to twist myself up as a Marxist apologist here, but there is one thing that he said, which was effectively that industrialization removed the worker from the tangible labor of their work, because they were sort of just like a cog in a machine. And, you know, that makes sense. And I think when you do that, and particularly once you compound that with the erosion of savings and that inability to store time, energy, value across time and space so that you can delay consumption, that has some sort of psychological degradation. Like, it destroys the will to be bothered to work. And so for those cognitively lazy, we'll just automatically reach to, well, someone needs to pay me to sit at home and watch Netflix because I have no motivation to do anything and I'm on meds or whatever the fuck. And, you know, it's this inception back of will, because when you have a sound money, when you see the benefits of what Bitcoin can do over a period of time, and particularly once you've like, to go down the rabbit hole and you've done the work to understand it, you're compelled then. You're compelled to use that will, take that will to act in a positive way, to start contributing, creating value,
and yes,
building yourself up. They are literally fashioning bootlaces to pull yourself up by, but you have to have the right materials to do it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with everything you said, except with the one caveat is I would change the word compel to impel.
Okay.
There's an intrinsic motivation that comes from, I mean, it's coming from without in a way that you have an incentive structure that allows you to keep the fruits of your own labor, but that it's the result of your work, frankly, right? It's like you getting to keep more of your work is what allows you to get a better toehold in the world. Maybe working as a cog in a machine wouldn't be so bad if you only had to do it, I don't know, half the week, half the year, whatever, you know, and you could accumulate some savings that could not be plundered, and then you would be free to go and be a scholar or do whatever you wanted to do. The real problem is when you get that plundering of savings compounded with the cog in a machine thing. I mean, I don't know that any of us can avoid, I mean, we're all a cog in a machine in a way, right? It's like you can kind of pick the sophistication of the machine you're working in, right? If you're very low skilled labor, then you might be doing a repetitive mind-numbing task 8 hours a day. If you want to develop more skills or more cognitive capacity, you could do something that's a little more sophisticated. But there is this element of work that it's always going to be work, right? It's not, you know, we call it work and not play for a reason. You know, hopefully you can find something you enjoy doing, and, you know, God bless those who do, right? The old saying is you find something you love doing, you never work a day in your life, right? But we still need garbage men, right? We still need whatever, like pick your occupation that people don't want to do. That maybe that's not so bad though.
No,
like,
I don't think it is.
Some people don't mind doing that stuff as long as they can just keep what they earn. Like, don't plunder the damn poor people, right? Just let them keep what they earn.
Do you know what I mean?
It won't be so bad for them or for us. And this line of thinking reminded me of a Thomas Sowell quote, because when you start to break this linkage, right, between, you're breaking the linkage between people's actions and the results of their actions. So you're almost like delaminating skin in the game, right? You're removing skin in the game through the printing of money, through the welfare state, through Marxist ideology, et cetera, right? Like the reason the guy is saying, well, oh, I'm getting plundered, or prices are going up so fast I can't keep up, I need a check from the government. What a vicious cycle that is, right?
It's crazy.
The reason prices are going up so fast and you need a handout from the government is because the government's printing money. And then they'll send you a check and you get deluded into thinking that, oh, well, they're the good guy now. They're helping me, the poor guy. But the reality is, you know, I looked at the numbers in 2020 when the U.S. printed $6 trillion. It came out to, I think there's 130 million U.S. households. So it came out to like $46,000 printed per U.S. household. And they sent each household a $4,000 check. Where did the other $42,000 go, right? It goes to Wall Street, political insiders, et cetera. But people at home, they don't understand this game. They don't understand the numbers. They're like, oh, thank you, Mr. Trump, or whoever sent the check, right? Whoever signed the check. But it's a scam, right? You're getting $4,000, but your purchasing power is going to be diluted to the tune of $46,000.
And it doesn't happen right away.
All right. That's right. I'll stop with this, but the Thomas Sowell quote that you reminded me of was, he said, the welfare state shields people from the consequences of their own mistakes, allowing irresponsibility to continue to flourish among ever wider circles of people. So again, the incentives, right? When you start to incentivize people to be lazy, irresponsible, incompetent, surprise, surprise, the general patterns of human action in the world start to reflect a lot more laziness, incompetence, etc.
And that's all reflected in the feedback loop back into the culture. So the quality diminishes of the output of all of the things that we enjoy as civilization, you know, when the mainstream shows and all the rest of it. I mean, like, the going back to the music analogy is sort of dear to my heart, but the quality of music, and I'm not some old person that's like, your music today is just shitty and it's not as good as it was back in my day. No, that's objectively, in my view, like, which is not objective, actually shittier than it was even just 20 years ago. And you can go back and there's some shitty songs on the radio from 20 years ago, but there's actual songwriting, there's lyrics, there's melody, there's harmonic composition, there's all these things. All of that's been devoid and removed, well, at least that you can find pockets of it, you know. I saw a band the other day, but it just feedbacks on itself, and it devalues the entire civilization.
Yes. Yeah. Again, I don't know if it's the money rabbit hole or what, but there does seem to be this metaphysical thing, right? When you dilute the savings of people, it starts to dilute everything. It just dilutes the process of civilization, the process of acculturation. You could maybe take it back to leisure. It's like you're subtracting leisure from people, right? By they're not keeping as much of what they earned. Prices are going up. So they're forced to work harder, basically. You're stealing their time, which is to say you are stealing their leisure. And if leisure is the fertile soil from which culture springs, well, then you're debasing the soil, right?
Yeah, it's erosion.
And so all of these knock-on effects, right? The architecture, the music, the food, the pharmaceuticals. I don't know about you, but like the amount of scams I have dealt with, just normal, someone steals your debit card information somehow online and they're shopping on Amazon. Like I order a vacuum cleaner and it never gets delivered and they won't respond to the email. It's like the number of scams seems to have surged in the past few years.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's my firm belief that that is all metaphysically interconnected to the debasement of money.
There was a post I saw of some Lurpak butter tied down with security devices in the fridge of the supermarket. Like, that's where we're at in the timeline.
Wow.
You know, we're securing butter because it gets stolen or something. Crazy. I don't know. It's insane. All right, look, I haven't even really touched on the spine of the questions that I tend to ask most guests. And I kind of knew that I wouldn't really because we just play on these threads. But there is one particular question that I really enjoy asking. How has discovering Bitcoin changed you?
It's a wonderful question. Well, pre-Bitcoin, I would say that I was a fiat chasing fuckboy to a large extent. I don't think I've ever been a particularly bad person, but I reached a point in my life where I had succeeded in most dimensions that I wanted to succeed in terms of like living where I wanted to live, being at a certain financial level that I wanted to be at, being, you know, single, in shape, whatever. And getting into Bitcoin and also becoming a father. I also became a father as I was getting into Bitcoin. So it's hard for me to disentangle which influence was which. Just showed me that a lot of my direction and metrics of success were just wrong. You know, like, I'm not going to say wrong, but we all go through a process of maturity. And I guess the metrics of success I had set out for myself quickly looked pretty shallow and meaningless to me as a result of getting into Bitcoin and or becoming a father around the same time.
Right.
And so it's also, I've always been a very curious person. I've always liked to read, but it has radically amplified that side of me. I guess it helps, again, that I have a lot of leisure now, thanks to Bitcoin, and I get to do this for a living. So I am one of those few people that genuinely enjoys what he does for a living. And, you know, I hope that shows my work. It definitely shows up in my quality of life and my fulfillment, fulfillment with my work. And so that's been a positive transformation. It is definitely made me a think boy for sure, right? Like I
You got to wear that with pride, by the way.
Constantly grappling with what is this thing? Are the implications of its emergence? How did we get to this point, right? You start, like, the veils of falsehood start to fall from your eyes, right? It's like getting unplugged from the matrix, and you just start to look at the world in a totally different way. Verveke uses this term, the arrow of relevance, where when you're younger and less mature, you tend to think the arrow of relevance tends to be pointed at you. How is the world relevant to me? How are these people relevant to me? How does this activity, how does it benefit me? Whereas in the process of maturity and growth, you start to reverse that arrow and, you know, say, how am I relevant to others? How am I relevant to the world? So it, I think this journey has certainly given me that dynamo flip of the arrow of relevance, where I've really started to try and consider, how am I showing up in the world? How am I adding value to other people's lives? You know, where are my blind spots? What, you know, where am I weak where I could be strong? Where am I doing wrong where I could be doing right? So you could perhaps gather all of that under the idea that it's been humbling. It's very humbling to get into Bitcoin, because you just, you know, you move much closer to that Socratic ideal of the only thing that I know is I know nothing at all, right? You really come face to face with the limitations of epistemology, knowledge, natural language. You start to have, I guess, more the right answers used to seem more obvious to me when I was younger. Right, they used to be simpler and more obvious. Now it's like things are very blurred at the edges. You know, things are very complex, just the way the world works, the way the human mind works, et cetera. And, you know, it may sound like we're often condemning the world as Bitcoiners, right? We're saying, oh, fiat reality, this, fiat food, fiat medicine, everything's shit, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is we've come a long way, frankly, right? We live in a lap of luxury compared to almost, well, basically any generation that comes before us, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't have refrigerators 150 years ago. So, like, imagine living without a refrigerator. You know, you get to keep food preserved fresh for weeks on end in the comfort of your own home. No one got to do that prior to whatever, 100, 150 years ago. So,
In my neighborhood, electricity, there's an area that wasn't connected to electricity until 1956.
There you go.
And they were using kerosene lamps and literally heading into town to buy ice, blocks of ice to keep their cool boxes. Like, wow.
Yes. So we have come a long way, and I'm guilty of this. I think a lot of Bitcoiners are, that we do have this tone of condemnation when we're talking about the world. But I think it comes from a good place, that we just see, we have a vision of the world that it can be better, you know, that we can strike at the root once and for all of so many problems in the world, which is this, you know, corruption of money, right? The central bank, the idea that we can, you know, use consumption to spur production, right? This inversion of economic reality is like, we just need to wake up from the delusion. All right, and understand that it takes work. You have to produce before you consume. We need to honor individual life, liberty, and property above all else. And the rest sort of sorts itself out. So I don't know. Bitcoin's been radically transformational on me, and I guess those are a couple of ways that it has been.
I love that answer. And I love the fact, when I ask that question, if I could just clip out every single person's answer from this pod and give that to someone that was skeptical of Bitcoin, like they would be orange pilled in a second, because not a single
person. We did the same thing with the what is money question.
Yeah.
We clip out all the answers to what is money and we turn it into whole episodes, and they've been very successful. You should do that.
Yeah. Well, time and energy, man. I need to get some more. but that idea that you could just, I mean, Bitcoiners, you're talking about like that, it's almost like an impatience. trying to get an ought from an is. Like, the world is the way it is, and we're like, yeah, but it ought to be this way, and it could be this way. If only you would stop LARPing over here. Because we've done the work, right? And I guess the deeper you go, so we've always got to be mindful of the fact that we got to look back up to the surface of that rabbit hole and realize that there is a lot of people still milling around it, wondering what the hell, should they dive in, should they not? Are they even aware of the hole, et cetera?
Yeah.
And be mindful of that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no one wants to be late to the party, right? Like, it's... I don't know. I just, again, you come to appreciate Bitcoin at whatever level you appreciate it, and you quickly want to evangelize it to everyone. But I found it to be more useful to just tell people, you know what, I would just encourage you to study Bitcoin or study the nature of money. I think you'll learn a lot in that process. And almost just leave it at that. It's like, you know, they decide for themselves. If they want to take your advice and do the work, then they'll come to their own conclusion and have their own light bulb moment. If not, that's fine. They can just go on living in the matrix and it is what it is. But when you come at them evangelizing, like, oh, you don't understand, it fixes everything. They're like, okay, crazy cult guy, like, I'm out. So I think it's more useful just to, what do they say? You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. You just sort of lead them to the water and let them do what they want.
I try and take on, I had John Vallis on early doors on this pod, and he said that you just, he's gone through that. He went through the Charlie Day phase, evangelizing it the whole lot. And now he's just like leading by example, right? And he's just leading a good life. And then if people tend to notice that, they might think, well, hang on a minute. How is John leading this good life? Right. What is the secret sauce here? There is a friend of mine, every time I talk to him, and I said to him yesterday, I ran into him five minutes, and I started talking about Bitcoin mining in Africa within a 5 minute conversation. So I still haven't quite learnt to sort of tamp down that Charlie Day craziness. Cause like, you know, sometimes you just want to shake these people and be like, man, honestly, everything that you keep saying to me is fucking annoying because I have the solution. If you'd only just look. Well, listen,
shout out to all the significant others of Bitcoiners out there that endure endless Bitcoin conversations.
Every movie is ruined now because he's just like, see, Bitcoin fixes that.
Yeah. Those memes of the guy standing at the corner of the party, you know, like everyone's having a good time. Yeah. Like, oh, I bet they don't even know Bitcoin fixes this. it's so true.
Yeah. Everyone's just too busy catching the game.
Yeah.
What does Bitcoin mean to you?
Freedom.
Yeah.
You know, I cannot fathom how anyone can create any argument against human freedom. It's like to even mount a counter argument and say, no, I think we need to do, you know, coerce people for A, B, and C. It's like you're literally expressing your human freedom in that argument. You're actually freely expressing yourself, and I'm not punching you in the face because I honor human freedom. Right. So it was like you want that for yourself. You're enacting that very essence of what that means. Yet you're through demonstration, you're showing that you value human freedom. Yet through explication, you're saying you don't. And so I don't know. For me, it's this word obvious has become very dangerous for me because maybe this is a Bitcoiner thing too. It's like you get deep into the rabbit hole and you're like, oh, that's obvious that this is a scam, or that's obvious that this is a fiat problem, or obvious that whatever. And other people don't see it as obvious, right? They don't see it at all in many cases. So this idea that human freedom is the most important thing in the world, right? Life, liberty, and property is abundantly obvious to me. Yet I feel like I am selling a very unique idea or something. It's like, it's not unique, it's not original, it's like, it's not my idea, it's, you know, as old as Western civilization. Right, since 1215, the Magna Carta, when King John signed the damn thing and said life, liberty, inviolable property, it's at least that old. So 800 plus years. Yet when you say it to people, they're like, I don't know. It does not compute for a lot of people. And they still think, you know, government fixes this or regulate me harder there or pass a tax to fix that. I'm just, Bitcoin means that we put all of that philosophical debate to rest and we just make it a political, and I'm using that term again in the sense of distributed ethics, right? Like we get a political, a politicized reality of honoring life, liberty, and property, right? It's like Bitcoin is almost like this incentive system that energizes proper ethicality. And that ethicality boils down to, well, do not violate life, liberty, nor property, which boils down to do not steal, which boils down to, above all, freedom.
Awesome. Robert, this has been a tremendous conversation. I knew it would be.
Thank you.
You've indulged my own predilections for think boy, you know, thinking and that sort of thing. It's just, yeah, it's just awesome, man. Thank you for sharing some scarce time, finite energy, telling us the tale of how you discovered Bitcoin and other things. Thanks, man.
Happy to do it, man. Thank you for having me.